many things that I have approached, with a concern that I have approached this one. Abraham Lincoln said on a famous occasion, people will little note nor long remember what we say here.
So true.
I hope that those of you who are here will carefully note and long remember what is said here. I will tell you what I'm going to do. First of all, I'm going to give you an account of a rebuke that I gave to some West Indian intellectuals and would-be revolutionaries about 5 years ago, and an account that I made a few days ago, especially for the sake of Ferguson. The second thing I'm going to take up is practical task, something that has happened in the revolution in Trinidad that is symptomatic of what is totally happening in the Caribbean. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go into a question of theory, theoretical facts, which have an imminent relation to the revolutionary situation in the Caribbean. And number four, I will finally go into what I'm going to propose that you should do, and not only what you should do, but we should see to it that is being done in the other parts of the Caribbean. So let us get clearly so that there will be no misunderstanding or uncertainty as to what you can expect. Number one, a repetition of a warning I gave to some young Western intellectuals about 4 years ago, and I have it repeated here even for the sake of Ferguson. Number two, I am going to take up something that has happened in the Caribbean recently that is symptomatic of the extreme revolutionary quality and the extreme revolutionary backwardness in the Caribbean. I hope we shall have a question and discussion that of these things. Number three, I shall go into questions of theory. Which are all closely related to fact. And finally, I shall go into what it is your business to do or see that it is done. It is now 8:20, 22. I don't think I will be speaking much longer than 9:30. Then I will be ready for questions and discussion, but purely on the matters that I bring before you. The first thing is, the other day I called up Bobby Hill, and Bobby will be here on Friday or Sunday, a man for whom I have great respect and great affection, and I called West Indian intellectuals after we had had a conference on the black writer. Bobby said for Ferguson to hear, I remember it extremely well. I said, do you remember my warning you all that you were taking steps and not taking the steps that were necessary? Bobby says, I remember it perfectly. I shut down. What I had told him was this. You all are talking about the revolution because after the meeting of black writers had been, after we had met in Canada, we met as a group of West Indian intellectuals talking about the situation. And they all talked about what they were doing. This one was getting a paper called up in, the other one was getting some people together, the others used to meet on a Tuesday night. The other ones are doing it, and I told them, what are you all doing? You all are crazy. There is a revolutionary situation in the Caribbean today. the revolution comes, as Marx says, like a thief in the night. And so you all babble about this, that, and the other, and you are not getting ready for the seizure of power. What club is this? And they looked at me, and they were somewhat bewildered. I believe they are still bewildered, some. And 1 year or 2 years afterwards, the situation broke out in Trinidad, and it has been running all through the Caribbean ever since. And it was necessary for me to make Ferguson understand that all that is taking place in the Caribbean, all that is taking place in Guyana, should have been known and prepared for. You don't wait until the revolution takes place and then you prepare for it or get ready. You prepare for it in advance. Quite often you prepare and it does not take place. But Marx's phrase is very important. It comes sometimes like a thief in the night. And I called up Bobby, and you will ask me when he comes here. But for this and to hear, I had told them. What was happening in Trinidad is no surprise to me. I would have been ready for it. And you all are not getting ready for the revolution developments that are likely to take place in the Caribbean. That is number one. That is what I called him up for. He said he remembered it perfectly, and he's coming here. When is he coming? Tomorrow night? What? Saturday. You can ask him about it. I told him, what are you all doing? You're just talking and talking about the revolution and what you are doing, but you are doing nothing. The question that matters is the question of the seizure of power, and that's what you have to get prepared for. That is point number one. Point number two is almost, not almost, but is far more important than that. Some young men the other day, or young men and young women in Trinidad, all of them, went into a bank and got hold of $200,000. That was a revolutionary act of the highest quality. You can say you are for, you can say you are against. I am not speaking about that. All I know is this, that the Bolshevik Party sternly forbade the robbery of banks and things of the kind. Except in a moment of revolutionary crisis, when everything was falling apart, then the party was entitled to rob money from banks as the case might be. But when the revolutionary crisis was over and things had gone back to normal, the party met and said, no more of this. I don't ask you to agree or not to agree. What I'm asking you to notice, they got together, organized themselves, and put their hands on $200,000. An act, whether you agree or not, of the first revolutionary importance. They did it in the morning. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, the police came, found 3 out of 4 of them there, shot them down, and took a large part of the money and took it away. I can't get it over. I can't get over it. You put your hand on $200,000 out of a bank. Half an hour afterwards, that money should have been perhaps on a plane going to Barbados or somewhere to be put aside, or something else to be done with it. But you don't get to go to sleep on that 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The police come and shoot you down and take the money back. What kind of business is that? I mean to say, you're richer than me. I'd be unsure, not one of them had ever put his hand on 200. And this time they put their hands on $200,000. That was a genuine revolutionary reaction, to organize it and manage a boat and then to go to sleep. And the police come and shoot you down and get back most of time into this. My friend, that's what we have to discuss. If you are not discussing that, and if you are not thinking in terms of the catastrophe that has been for the revolutionary movement and for everybody, you are not talking about the revolution at all. That is the point I wish to make to you. Number one, it was a revolutionary act of the highest quality. And what happened to it afterwards was the most shameful degradation and revolutionary activity and preparation. So they closed them and jumped with them, and that is what the Caribbean is. That is what the Caribbean is. I hope I will hear some discussion or some talk about it. Because in addition to the catastrophe for themselves, you know, the lift of that gives to the police and all those who are against, and how the ordinary people are demoralized by that event. The revolution has been struck a great blow, better they hadn't gone for the money at all. But to take it and get shot in the same afternoon is money taken away from you. Somebody told on them. That's okay with me. If they told on me, the money would have gone. There would have been nobody would have been told that the money had gone. These days are the actual elements that we have to deal with. Now I'm going to deal with a certain theoretical questions which apply very urgently to the situation today. Now the slaves in San Domingo fought a war. They won their freedom, and then Napoleon, not satisfied, he sent an army there to fight against the Haitians. And I hope the time comes when you will ask me the question. The generals who were slaves, and who have become generals because of the revolution, they were not prepared to pick up themselves and fight against the new invasion. They were prepared to take it. Now sometimes, very often, I have written things which I don't understand. But some instinct tells me when I'm faced with it, goes this way. And more often than not, I go the right way. Here am I writing about the revolution in San Domingo. The second time the revolution took place against the army that Napoleon had sent to restore slavery. Page 338 of my book. This is a man who writes memoirs of the revolution, Lacroix. And he says, but no one observed that in the new insurrection of San Domingo, as in all insurrections which attack constituted authority, it was not the above chiefs who gave the signal for revolt, but obscure creatures, for the greater part, personal enemies of the colored generals. These generals who had been slaves and who had made themselves into heads of this and that and the other, when the time came for them to defend the revolution, they didn't defend it. Pamphile de Lacroix says, let me repeat it, but no one observed that in the new insurrections of San Domingo, Karl Marx and Lenin would have observed it, and they have thought that to me, but no one observed that in the new insurrection of San Domingo, as in all insurrections which attack constituted authority, it was not the above chiefs who gave the signal for revolt. It was not the chiefs, but obscure creatures, for the great part, personal enemies of the colored generals. I hope you understand that, and are able to say yes or no, as the case may be. Now, I wrote that in 1938, and I didn't understand it well. I had a vague idea what it meant, but time passed, and in 1962, after an experience in Trinidad in particular for 5 years, side by side with the local government, and reading various books and looking at the world generally, I decided to add a few pages to this book, The Black Jacobins. And on page 338, I added a footnote, and it is that footnote that I wish to draw to your attention. I say that in regard to this passage that Pampita Vata had written, in that it was the rank and file of obscure people, enemies of the generals who led the second revolution, I say Misre had shown that such was also his view of the French Revolution. Misre is one of the finest historians who has ever written. Chicago is republishing, I would recommend you to read the book. Misre had shown, I say, that such was his view of the French Revolution. All of the talkers, the orators, the rest of them, Misre said, no, people, it was the news that came from the rank that made the great news of the revolution. And I go on. This is in Charles Lefebvre, the great contemporary historian of the French Revolution, who on occasion after occasion exhaustively examines all the available evidence and repeats that we do not know and will never know who were the real leaders of the French Revolution, nameless, obscure men, far removed from the legislators and the public orators. I don't know if that means something to some of you. Lefebvre is the finest historian of the French Revolution since Michelet 100 years ago. And he says we do not know and will never know who were the real leaders of the French Revolution. Nameless, obscure men, far removed from the legislators and the public orators. That is happening in the United States. Who led the disturbances in what? Who led them in Washington, D.C.? Who led them in Detroit? We don't know. Nameless, obscure men. And you have to be one of the nameless, obscure men in the Caribbean if we're talking about the future of the Caribbean, or you have to find out who are the nameless, obscure men, and not those whose names are in the papers all the time. Now, Lefebvre wrote in The Flight of the King, a memoir Lefebvre that I picked up in Paris one day. I went there in 1953. I'd been away from Europe for 15 years. And I went around. I know where to look at the rules. You don't always find. But I found these lectures, memoir, they're not printing. And Lefebvre says, it is wrong to attach too much importance to any opinion that the hero there or Robespierre might have on what needed to be done. And always remember that in a revolution, the struggle is not against the government. Never. The government is defeated. That's why the revolutionary crisis begins. The struggle is between the right wing and the left wing of the revolutionary elements. That's what is going on in all the Caribbean today. Williams is living by the skin of his teeth if he has any more remaining. The struggle is between what is to be done, between the right wing and the left wing of the revolution, between, in France, the Girondins and Robespierre, the Girondins on the right, Robespierre on the left. And he goes on to say, it is wrong to attach too much importance to any opinion that the Girondins or Robespierre might have on what needed to be done. Then comes a simple sentence. That is not the way to approach the question. That is not the way to approach the question. We must pay more attention to the obscure leaders and the people who listen to them in stalls and the little workshops and dark streets of old Paris. Do you feel that this applies to you where you have to look for what is to take place in the Caribbean? If you don't look for it, it will never take place. You and such as you will get nothing but blow. So look in the dark streets of old Paris. It is therefore in the popular mentality, in the profound and incurable distrust which was born in the soul of the people in regard to the aristocracy, There is an incurable distress that exists in the masses of the population, in all government and others in the Caribbean today. I want to use those words, and I want to know if you accept the incurable distress in the popular mentality. Then can you get better words to express what is taking place in Trinidad? The incurable distress in the popular mentality, that we must seek the explanation of what took place. And then he says, the people and their unknown leaders knew what they wanted. They followed the Girondins and afterwards Robespierre, only to the degree that their advice appeared acceptable. Who then are these leaders to whom the people listened with no son? Nevertheless, as in all the decisive days of the revolution, when what we would most like to know is forever out of our reach, we would like to have the diary of the most obscure of these popular leaders. We would then be able to grasp in the actual to speak how one of these great revolutionary days began. We do not have it. That is what he has discovered about 1950, about the French Revolution that took place of 180 years before. We don't know, because the obscure men who led it, we don't know anything about them. And the same thing is happening in the United States and in the Caribbean today. And you have to know that. You have to begin to know what you're looking for. Because if you don't know what you're looking for, you can't find it. And then Lefebvre, who had led the revolution, he sends somebody home to Napoleon and he tells him, the state in which the colony of San Domingo finds itself, by the fatal destruction of its army and by the insurrections excited by the decrees of General Richefas and Guadeloupe, appears to me so disturbing that I have decided to send you General Moody. Believe what he will tell you, and now listen to this, not in 1802, but in 1973. We have in Europe a false idea of the country in which we fight and the men whom we fight against. That is what is taking place in the Caribbean today. Forgive me if I get a little bit excited, but I've known this for years. We have in Europe a false idea of the country in which we fight and the men whom we fight against. People don't understand what is taking place in the Caribbean. That is one part of the history, the theory that I'm going to take. The second part I will take from a journal called Havana Journal. I went to Havana in 1967 as part of a group of intellectuals. There were about 450 of us. And Andrew Salky was there. And Andrew wrote an account of it afterwards, and the book was published by Pelican. It's a Pelican original. And I recommend the book to you. Now we went there, and I, with many of the others, stayed in what had been the Hilton Hotel in Havana. But there were not many cars in Havana because they didn't get the spare parts, and America prevented them from buying. They were in a lot of trouble. But every day, as soon as you step downstairs from the Hilton, where you have breakfast in bed, a lot of coffee, eggs and bacon, and I don't know what the rest of the people were eating but that, and you wanted some more coffee, you could run up, call them, sir, somebody came up. So after we talked about that, we were intellectuals from all over the world. I told some of them, now look at this, what is this? If I want to have breakfast in bed and people to come there, I don't want to come to Havana for that. I have come here to discuss the revolutionary movement and what we have to say. So I got a lot of people with me to agree. At night I didn't get them to agree, but I talked about it and people said, yes, what is this? So I talked about it and I made an intervention at one of the workshops. We were divided into three big workshops, and I made intervention with one which was dealing with the role of the intellectual. And Sarki says, Robert Hill, John. Great consolation for all of us to see how fighting fit CLR looks. I wasn't very well, and they took very good care of me, I must say. He promised upon for Roberto Retamar, who has been writing, during the resumption of the commission with his paper aimed against the intellectual, that my paper, 1967. Robert Hill, that's Bobby, will be coming on Saturday. John and I, a little cautious about the prospect of the paper's success. The paper was a tremendous success, I'll tell you how. CLR, very optimistic at me. His intervention yesterday on the luxury question was reported with his picture in the papers, and has obviously given the delegate from Trinidad and Tobago, that is me, an enormous fillip. I didn't depend on any publishing in the papers with my picture to give me a fillip. I had it. I had gained it from many years of study. Marcus, that's my, the man who was attending to me, sensed the element of risk but didn't comment. Now, next day we meet about 120 of us from all over the world. See, I've been reading 115. I will read plainly what I have said there, because unless you know that, you are going to... CLR held up his hand for permission to read his 10 points paper. Now, it is quite a thing in a commission to get up and ask to read the 10 points. That a God could give 10 commandments for me. You don't go to a commission and ask for 10 points, but I ask for permission to read my 10 points paper. I ask for permission because I have already talked to many of the delegates. I didn't rush into a commission and ask for permission for 10 points. And got it immediately from the president of the commission, that's Retamar. Along with the very prompt granting of permission, Roberto Retamar also addressed CLR as Professor Jans, which John and I thought a timely little honor, and one which we believe CLR himself would have considered a demotion. I don't want to go to a conference of intellectuals all over the world and be called Professor Jans. I don't go to go to teach anybody anything. I want to hear. He was called Professor Jans throughout the rest of the Congress. I get an impression that Retamar had heard or suspected that I was going to be troublesome. CLR King's ready summary, which he stressed should be listened to as a scenario of varied and dissimilar points for discussion, and not as a commission paper with a coherent argument on a single theme. Here are my 10 points. Number one, I view with misgiving and doubt the enormous potentialities and responsibilities of this Congress, and on the other hand, the limitations with which it has been organized, and the luxurious atmosphere in Cuba to which the delegates are submitted. What about this breakfast in bed? You come downstairs, there is turkey and ham, and if 1 week walk out the building, a man is there, Professor Jams, you want to go somewhere? I say, yes, I'm going to the opera. He says, we will get a taxi for you. The people struggling. What are you get a taxi for me? For where am I going to tell you that I need a taxi with a lot of people in Cuba talking about? So I said, this thing that we have come here, we haven't come here for this. That's point number one. Point number two. The world ushered in by Christopher Columbus and Martin Luther no longer exists because Christopher Columbus did not discover America. Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama and Magellan, they created and discovered not America but the world market. That is what is the importance. So you have two sets of people, some who go about saying, Christopher Columbus discovered America, great man. And then you say, Christopher Columbus discovered America, nonsense. America was there before he came. Both of them are quite wrong. Columbus did an important job, but Da Gama and Magellan, between them all, when they were young, the world market was discovered. And I said, the world that they began no longer exists. Lenin, Gandhi, Mao, Mao Zedong, and Fidel Castro have shattered its foundation. You see, I am a man of a certain age. I was born in 1901, and I know the old world. You people don't know it. But that old world, that was sound and solid. This one is not. Nobody knows what will happen tomorrow. No president or prime minister knows. Kissinger thought he had made an arrangement. He hadn't. Now that I say that was no longer this, that's point number two. Now I say point number three, and I'm speaking to people of the Caribbean, the territory and type of people to which our hosts and the organizers of this Congress belong, has played a highly significant role in the destruction of the political control of one area. You cannot discuss the political control that has been lost in Africa without coming to the people of the Caribbean. Such names as Marcus Garvey, George Patmore, and Frantz Fanon, all three from the Caribbean, occupy a role in the destruction of European control of Africa entirely out of proportion to the size of the area to which they belong. In this Congress, the reason for that must be one of our basic benefits. How does it happen that from the Caribbean islands, these insignificant, unimportant scraps of territory, just 21 miles long by 14 miles across, there come these people who alter the proportions of political control in the world? You cannot think about the independence of Africa without thinking of the men who have to lay foundations. Point number four. The history of Western civilization cannot be written without the name of Bellow. Dumas, one of the greatest romantic novelists who ever wrote, Le Comte de Lille, who headed the Parnassian movement, Jose de Heredia, who did the same, masters of French literature at a certain time, Saint John Perse, grew up in Guadeloupe, where his father was a French official, white but still West Indian, M.A. Césaire, one of the greatest writers of the day, and the present group of West Indian novelists, of whom I name in this summary, Alejo Carpentier and Wilson Harris, and the American revolutionary leader, Stokely Carmichael, who was born in Trinidad. In those days, Stokely used to speak. He was one of the three finest speakers I have ever heard. The three finest speakers I have ever heard are a Welshman called Anurin Bevan, a tremendous orator. The second one, the other one, I don't want to give them marks, I'm not setting an exam, Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro is a speaker you get once in 100 years. And Stokely is addressing number three. But I heard him in Canada, and when he came to England in 1967, talking about this third world, the struggle against imperialism, and black power, the highest point of the third world. I mean, he shook the British Empire there. Mr. Wilson said, don't let that young man come back here. He's an undesirable citizen. They were not in that. I have never, in the course of 30 years of my experience in British politics, I have never known them to say they didn't want anybody who had spoken there to return. Never. A man is still young, he will come again. Now number five, this unprecedented role of West Indian intellectuals, please take note, Mrs. West Indian intellectuals, this unprecedented role is due to the fact that the population of an underdeveloped area, because by themselves what will be Trinidad and Tobago and Barbados and Jamaica, be nothing from these parts of territory, uses a highly developed other languages. We didn't make those languages. They have been created abroad by centuries of history, uses highly developed modern languages, and though many of us live at a level little above that of slavery, the structure of life is essentially European. That is the kind of people we are. You know, it's only within the last 2 or 3 years that some West Indians are able to say this land we wanted. They have never been able to say so in the past. And after an Indian living on the earth with 1 rupee across her own stomach, he can tell the British, get out of here. He said, my time is here, my great grandfather is here, we have lived here for 1,000 years, you get out. But the West Indian got from Oxford and from New York and from Harvard, he can't say that. You know why? Because he never owned it. He went to other stables. He has no sense in his head of having owned it. So to say I want it, he can't say I want it back because he never had it. So that the years passed by and they flew along with British parliamentary policies. Government, opposition, opposition, government. This is a game that they play. There's no sense to it. Now, so I say that situation, it is that situation, this people of an underdeveloped country using a modern language and using all the advantages of a modern structure that has produced this remarkable body of intellectuals, both in politics and in literature, whose climax has been attained in the pure revolution. It's not something that took place in Cuba. It is the highest point of a development that is taking place in the whole of the Caribbean. And if you don't think of yourself that way, you don't understand what is happening, and you cannot intervene. The highest point of the Cuban Revolution, the highest point of West Indian development is the Cuban Revolution, which Fidel Castro. That's where you belong. That's where I belong. And nobody's going to find that out till you. You have to decide. Number 7, the Cuban Revolution tells us that the remarkable contribution which the West Indian type of intellectual has made to the emancipation of Africa, that's a big phrase for a big thing, and to the development of Western civilization, have now come to an end. That is now ending. This unprecedented capacity for creative contributions to civilizations must not now be primarily applied abroad as formerly in regard to Africa or to the development of French or British literature, but it is in the application of that capacity to the life of the Americas that the West Indian intellectual will find the necessary elements for the development of culture in the underdeveloped countries. And this must not be forgotten in the developed countries as well. That tremendous city, the names that I have called, these are West Indians, Dalí, Dumas Stearns, and Dumas, his son, Le Comte de Lille, José de Heredia, Saint John Cross, Emile César, and the present group of West Indian novelists, Ali Holt, Carpenter, Wilson Harris, George Lamming, Bridger Nicol, where you can get 3 writers equal to Bridger Nicol, George Lamming, and the other one. Wilson Harris, where in what country where the English language is written, you will find 3 of them. And this is something that has been going on right through the 19th century. But that capacity, that tremendous creative capacity that we have shown since the Cuban Revolution, it is clear, no longer is that to be applied outside to African, European, French and English literature. It is to be applied at home. That's what the Cuban Revolution says. Do it here. And the victory that they will follow. And as you write and speak, you must be aware that a new stage in history has been entered upon. This requires that the mass base which the West Indian intellectual needed to find in Africa and in the literature of Europe must now be sought for in the population of the West Indies itself. And if you understand what has taken place in the Haitian Revolution, you know that that mass base is there. You have to look for it, it's there. If you are not looking, that's why you don't find it. This population is unique. The West Indian population is unique. That it is the population of an underdeveloped country where the language of the great mass is an advanced European language. There is nothing you can tell of the most advanced state which he cannot understand, because he is brought up as his native language. I have never spoken to any set of people that I really can understand what I will say. Where would the people of the Venus of Mati go? To go where they would have developed a language like the British language. But we have at our disposal not only the language but the technical discoveries of the tremendous civilizations of the United States, of Britain, and of Canada. All that is ours to play with and do what we like with it. And we have made tremendous contributions to it. The time has come for us to take that capacity that we have developed and apply it to the local situation. Now, number 9, I made a point. The population should have been formally represented here in this Congress, because I say you call a Congress of intellectuals of the world in a socialist country using a modern language, familiar with modern languages. And in this Congress, the working class of Cuba is not represented. I said, what would you do? We are intellectuals here. That's our good luck and our misfortune. But here you are intellectuals and you have a socialist proletariat. Go out to be here discussing with the intellectuals of the world, listening to what we have to say, and then we listen to what they have to say. I said, you haven't done that. That's what your conference is, that's what it ought to be. Number 10, and I do a final conclusion. The function of this Congress is that intellectuals should prepare the way for the abolition of the intellectuals as an embodiment of culture. Now you people from the Caribbean had better understand. The Caribbean Revolution will present the abolition of the intellectuals as the embodiment of culture, the abolition of the intellectuals as masters of the sugar estates, the abolition of the intellectuals and the leading groups. Everywhere in the Caribbean, the mass of the population can take care of what it means. If you don't do that, go home and join them on ministry. The function of this Congress, I came to a conclusion, that is a result of what I've seen of the Caribbean people, what I wrote them, what I found in this book, what I found in many other places, and what I read that Lefebvre said about the mass of the people in France in 1780.